Hi, everyone. So on this call, we're discussing the weaning decision. It's one of the key dates on the calendar for sheep and beef farmers, provided you remember to put the bulls and rams out, of course. It's the completion of the mating, the gestation, the lactating part of the year, when the ewe or the cow's job is over, or for the time being. And it's the start of finishing activity when lambs and calves are growing on their own. At the same time, and we'll talk about this, I think, a bit tonight, it's when the business of getting the ewes and cows back into good condition and achieving excellent conception starts all over. So if you've been to many field days over the last 20 years or more, certainly in my part of the world, but pretty much the length and the breadth of the country, the chances are you've already heard tonight's guest speaker. And if it wasn't at a field day, then maybe at a Grassland Association conference, we certainly will have read some of his work in numerous industry publications. Dr. David Stevens is based at Ag Research Inverleigh, and he's known for his expertise in pastoral systems, be it sheep, beef or deer, and it's had him travelling the length and breadth of New Zealand, and indeed, occasionally in farming media or on social media, you'll see he spent some time overseas as well. So welcome onto the podcast, David. In a minute, you've got some prepared remarks, and then we're going to get into some questions and answers, but first, just as a bit of a background, what's your role or your job title currently with Ag Research and maybe the potted history of your career, how you ended up where you are now?
All right, thanks for that, Aaron. Very generous introduction. So I'm currently a senior scientist with Ag Research in our farm systems team. And I suppose the reason you end up in the farm systems team is because you have a reasonably varied career and set of expertise. So I started out my career a very long time ago looking at the performance of pasture species in hill country, in particular dry hill country. And then we moved on from measuring dry matter into measuring animal responses so that we could actually quantify what those pastures really did for the farmer. And so they don't really just grow grass, they actually grow animals because that's what you sell. And then after a few years at that, I decided I actually needed a bit more depth in my animal nutrition. So I went overseas, did my PhD in North Carolina, and then came back to Invermere and have worked with our farm systems group there and our deer team ever since. I suppose the key area of interest to me is actually how to translate that science into farmer decision-making. And how we can convert those sort of decisions into more money in the pocket for the farmer or better ways to do things. So that's a very brief history of where I've come from.
Good as gold, and no doubt we'll expand a wee bit more on some of those things later on tonight, because I think we've entitled this session The Weaning Decision, but there's a lot happens before that and there's a lot happens after it, which is what we're going to get into around that decision making. So we've got some questions and answers, but one of the things we would give you the opportunity is just a few prepared remarks and the key things you really want to get across or reinforce to farmers, David. So I'll hand over to those for the next 5 or 10 minutes.
Yeah, okay. Thanks, Aaron. I suppose I've sort of split it into three parts here. And one is the before weaning and what you're looking for as you approach weaning, and then what do you do during the weaning process, and then afterwards. So how do you deal with what you end up with, just a little bit, because they're all quite important parts of the process. And I suppose by breaking it down like that, you can start to think about how you're going to plan your way through this. Because as you suggested right at the start, Aaron, this is a key part of the whole farming calendar. And so really, as you approach weaning, what you're doing is you're balancing your feed supply and demand. And the people who know most critically about that are the guys in some of our dry East Coast areas, where they have to balance that decision very, very finely as to what they've got. But the other thing you're actually balancing in that process is the competition between the ewe and the lamb, or between the cow and the calf. And we don't think very much about that, but it is quite critical to how you make that decision. So And we'll come back to that. I think there was a question a wee bit later on around that, and some of it actually relates to some of the work we've done on creep grazing of lambs as well. But I suppose the very short part of that is that if there's competition for feed, then the adult always beats the young, right? So that's quite key to keep in your mind as to how that process works. The ewe dries herself off and continues to eat grass, which the lamb really needs to grow. So we have to balance that particular approach. So really key to think about how that works on your farm. Because again, if we look at the information that we have and we've measured on farm around New Zealand, the wheels really come off in that last 3 or 4 weeks before the weaning decision's made. If there's a gap that opens up between high performers and those who don't quite get the weaning weight that they want, it's at that time. It's not so much early on in the piece. And again, there's a wee question we have later on around how we balance the very early part of the lactation process. But most of the time we find that the wheels really start falling off in the latter part of that lactation. So that's where the ewe dries off, the lamb gets out competed, all of a sudden you've got a 21 kilo lamb and it doesn't meet your spec. So that's quite crucial to be looking at that balance and going, have I got enough feed? Is it the right quality? Which way is the feed going? Because the other interesting thing that we've found in some of our work with deer actually is as you eat down into the feed that you thought you had in spring, especially in late spring, the feed quality doesn't get better, it gets worse. Because the animal is now eating down into the dead material that you left behind earlier on in the season. And so again, now you've got a quality issue at the same time. So again, that balancing act as to how you do that. And so that's sort of that beforehand is getting that balance right. So which bits are you looking for? You're looking at the quality of the feed, you're looking at whether the feed supply is going up or down, you're looking at what the condition of the ewe is, whether she's already dried off, and how much competition she's putting on the lamb or on the calf, if in the case of the cow. So they're quite key parts to that. Now the next bit is during the weaning process. Now, it's interesting as I go around the country, you get to see a lot of people and they talk about the weaning and it's a really big deal and they try to get it over as fast as possible. Now, what I would suggest here is this is the one point in the whole of the production cycle where you really need a good inventory of what you have. So I wouldn't be rushing this process. I'd be planning it really well. So one of the farmers that we've been working with on the east coast of the North Island went through the process and decided that that's when his inventory was the most important. He needed to know what his ewe lambs weighed. He needed to know what his finishing lambs weighed. He needed to know what the condition score of the ewe was. All of those things so that he could plan his next stage. So what he did, instead of trying to rush through thousands of lambs, what he did is he broke it down and said, we can handle X number of lambs in a day in a timely fashion. We can finish at 3 o'clock in the afternoon so everybody isn't exhausted. We can make sure that they all go through the process. They all get weighed. The ewes all get condition scored. They all get split into their next mobs, both the ewes and the lambs. And then tomorrow we'll come back and we'll do another group that's quite easy to do. You know, and just work through that so you get a full inventory of what you're dealing with, because it is a really crucial part of the whole system. He went to the whole extent of actually hiring a cook to cook breakfast for all of the staff, make sure everybody was happy with the process rather than pushing people really hard at that time of the year. Now, that takes quite a bit of planning, but the point is you now have an inventory from which you can work and actually set your goals and targets with a lot more accuracy. And you can now go into your summer with not only knowing what you've got, but now you can look at your pastures and what you're going to feed them and all those sort of things. So it's a really quite a critical time getting that process right. So the other thought in there, and I'll talk about it now, but someone else was talking, when one of the questions was, do you put the lambs back in the same paddock that they came from to settle them down and all those kind of things? So some of the logistics around that process. The important part in that is to make sure that lambs are familiar, particularly with their environment and their feed. But so they might not have to go back into exactly the same paddock they came from, but they need to go into the same part of the farm that they're used to. Now, that may mean prior to lambing, you have to manage the process so that the lambs actually do see that part of the farm. So one of the key issues that we see is somebody saving something like red clover and chicory and plantain or whatever specifically for the lambs, and then they put the lambs on it, and then so they don't do very well. Well, they don't do very well because it's a very unfamiliar feed. So they all prick around the edges. We've all seen that. And they eat all the annual grasses and probably eat the weeds before they actually go onto the crop. Well, they need to be socialized with that crop before you wean them. So they need to have some sort of familiarity with it. And the best way to teach them is to have them with their mothers. So that's a reasonably critical part, especially if you're looking at using specialist things. Yep. So, and then after that weaning process, that's when you've got your ewes or your cows in different condition scores so that you can then manage them appropriately to get them back into good breeding condition. It's an important time actually for your ewe hoggets, and looking after them and meeting your targets with them, whatever those targets look like. And then a little bit after the weaning process is when you want to come back in and look at things like udder health. So doing that on the day of weaning is not a good idea. You will cull out far too many on hard udders and all that sort of stuff. You've actually got to leave them maybe 3 or 4 weeks and go back in at that time and have another look through them to pick out some of those defects. So that's probably where I'm up to at the moment with my thinking, Aaron, with the sort of the planning beforehand, thinking about that balance between feed and competition. Then during the process, all about making sure you get your inventory so you know what you're working with. Do it in a considered manner. Don't rush it. Make sure you take your time and get that right. And then afterwards, you're looking at what your priorities look like, and maybe coming back to the ewes for other health and things like that.
Brilliant. Excellent. Thanks, David. I have been silent, but I've been busy writing furiously a few notes and expanding on things we want to follow up on later. It's an unusual format, this, for a speaker when they get no sort of feedback from the interviewer or the listeners, but we've got a number of things we want to build on. So, look, I just want to start around that first decision ultimately around a lot of weaning stuff is when, and you sort of touched on the inventory gathering information for making that decision. I think there's still a lot of people out there, and, you know, we've talked about a lot of field days. I heard you talk about the main thing they monitor is to when they're going to wean is the calendar, because that's the day they wean, and they've always weaned on that date, and that's the way it should happen. Do you want to maybe just expand a wee bit more on pre-weaning or coming up to weaning, the sort of information you would encourage farmers to gather to help make the decision? Is it stock condition, pasture cover, soil moisture, all those sorts of things? What would you recommend they're looking at?
Yeah, so you've touched on a few of those already there, Aaron, and I suppose the key indicator that you have is how well your lambs and your ewes are doing. They are the ultimate reflection of your feed supply at the time. So we, down south, it's reasonably straightforward. So the south of the Waitaki River, there's probably a need to at least go in and check and make sure there's no parasites about late November. And so you're going to be bringing those animals in and looking at them anyway. So taking a weight then and getting maybe a reflection on what they were doing last year and then looking at how much feed's in front of them for the next month or so before you really think you're going to wean might be one way of doing that, and putting a hand on some ewes and seeing what condition they are, and maybe testing some udders and seeing whether they're actually still milking. So getting those sheep in around about a month before you normally make your decision and seeing which way they're going. Okay, so you know, what condition are they in, all those sort of things. And like you say, you want to tie that into some of your other indicators. So your indicators are what's going to happen next. So one of those, obviously, is soil moisture. So, and again, it's about knowing what happened last year in your environment, and therefore what is likely to happen again. And I suppose in that instance, it's really about how different is the soil moisture compared to what it usually is in my environment, right? So it's not about a specific number. It's about what's different from last year when I might have to make a different decision. So if the soils are drier than they were last year and the long-range forecast is for less rain, then you're going to be thinking, I'm going to make this decision earlier. So they're probably the two really big indicators that you're looking for.
Uh-huh.
Of course, you will have a bit of, you might have some feed that's been left over or new feed that's grown, and again, you'll be looking at, so have I got enough to meet the requirements of the ewe and the lamb together, or should I separate them apart? So again, if I'm a little bit short of feed, we can reduce the feeding requirement in total by taking the ewe and the lamb, separating them out, and feeding them individually. You will actually reduce the total demand, and that will prolong your feed supply. So they're probably the biggies right at the moment. But that monitoring is actually quite important.
So, which leads nicely into the next question, and this is one I was quite keen to hear from you again. You and I probably first started working together or worked alongside each other right back in the mid-90s, and the thing I remember very strongly from then, a message you and others were getting across, was the importance of lambs being not just the competition with the ewe, but a lamb being good enough when it's weaned to go on and survive and thrive on pasture. And a sort of a rule of thumb, I remember, I hope I remembered it correctly, David, was around that time not weaning below 25 kilos, a lamb that's below 25 kilos, because at that stage the protein and the energy supply from pasture is typically not good enough. Have I got that right? Can you expand on that? And, is that sort of it's not just the competition side of things. We do really want to be aiming to have lambs at a minimum weight when we wean them.
Yeah, so that's actually a physiological process and part of the digestion process. So once they're over around about 25 kilos, then they can digest the proteins in grass and supply enough to meet their needs for growth. And they can grow quite fast. That's not limiting anymore. Below 25, their protein requirement goes up because they're mostly laying down bone and protein. So it's actually quite a high protein part of the process. And if they're on grass, and I say grass quite specifically, then they don't get enough protein, even if you put nitrogen on the grass and drive the crude protein levels up. They actually don't get enough out of it. The work that was done back in the 70s in particular helps us make a better decision these days if we're working with lucerne or we're working with red clover and chicories and white clover, some of the specialist mixes. Their protein concentrations are much more digestible and much more appropriate to meet the animal's demands. And, of course, the protein in those plants is a lot higher as well. So we can actually get down to about 18 kilos and still meet those protein demands with something like your lucernes or your red clovers or your white clovers. So that gives us flexibility now, I suppose, with a lot of the new specialist pastures that we're putting in. So that's a real opportunity in the drier environments, to be able to go, okay, well, we can keep them running quite fast on those diets, and again, reduce our demand, get the ewes back on the hill somewhere. But again, with the proviso that those lambs should have seen that feed before they get weaned so that they know what to do with it when you put them out there.
Hmm. And the key with that figure too is that that's not just the average of the mob, that's the minimum, you know. So if it's 25 or it's 18, if you've got the high quality product, you don't want to be weaning lambs below that weight. So ideally we wouldn't
not
be, but you're talking a split weaning, you know, a skim weaning or things like that.
So that brings in some of your management opportunities in there. Maybe it is that you split the weaning and the heavier ones go off first and the others stay with their mothers. Again, as long as the mother is providing milk. If the mother's not providing milk, then you're not getting any advantage out of that. But really, yeah, I'm hoping that one day we'll be talking about all the lambs are weaned at 34 kilos, so we don't even have this conversation, to be really honest. but again, it's very much a, we need to know that physiology so that when we are in times of stress or drought or whatever else, we can still make a really good decision. And you're right, Aaron, they really are aiming to be minimum values.
No, it's interesting. You know, we look back, it's not that long ago, and I hope I'm not that old, but it's interesting to see how far we have come and what I see in weaning weights out there and lambs, and some of the issues we had back then are not so common anymore. But, I know at the time, and it's still a question, is a lot of places we see some years have a great weaning, fantastic lambs, and the next year they'll be right back and quite a big variation in the weight. You touched a wee bit on this at the start in terms of, you know, how those that consistently get good performance wean good lambs, get it right, particularly in those last few weeks. But just what are the key drivers of lamb weaning weight? Is it, you know, just up the chance we had a good winter, we had a good spring? Or what are the things that leading up to weaning, and, you know, we're late into this year, but for coming years that people can focus on to make sure they get those lambs to a good weaning weight, almost not completely irrelevant, but, you know, almost irrespective of the things that are out of our control?
Yeah, no, I think you touched on it really nicely when you said, we've had a mild winter, so we're going to be okay. So what we need to do is unpick that mild winter and say, so what did we actually control, or what maintained itself, or how did that go, right? So what you'll find, inevitably, is that when we have a mild winter, we have better pasture utilization, the ewe retains her condition better going into spring, and then regardless of the conditions in spring, she now has a buffer on her back of energy that she can call on to make sure that lactation demands are met, right? And what we found with a it was actually an on-farm set of work that we did, there was about 11 or 12 farms involved. What we found was half a condition score at the start of lambing was worth another 3 kilos of weaning weight. Now that becomes really, really crucial if you've had quite a mild winter and then you have a cold, dry spring, for example, and the feed isn't quite there. Now the feed's already on the back of the ewe in the form of condition. She can use that to supplement her lactation and make sure you get quite a consistent product out the other end. So that's part of the process. The other one that we've worked on quite hard is been looking at how much feed we have in front of the ewe at lambing. And again, we can, if we have enough feed, we can weather out some of the storms of, or the issues that you might have with, especially with early spring production. So we used to talk about, and very commonly talk about, 1,000 kilos of cover at lambing, and that was quite a common metric. And then we got people talking about 1,200. And now we have farmers talking about, if we haven't got 1,500, you know, there's something wrong. Again, that's about getting that buffer of feed in front of the ewe to make sure that she lactates properly, and that, again, you're not completely at the vagaries of how much grass turns up on the day. So it's getting that process sorted out as you go. So they're probably the two really big drivers of what happens through the spring. How much energy have you got stored on you? So you haven't used it up through the winter by running air condition down. And how much pasture can you get in front of her as soon as the lamb hits the ground? And that gets everything really well set up for the rest of the process.
Now, I want to come back to that, because I know it's, a bit of work that you've been heavily involved in around, basically, we're talking about weaning, but starting right back at the start of the winter, the feed budgeting, the rotation and all those sorts of things. But hopefully we'll get onto that a wee bit later, and there's just a few other things we want to deal with. You touched on weaning lambs back into paddocks, which is one of the other questions, but another one you touched on a wee bit around the monitoring and so on that's been going around is internal parasites. So what's your thoughts on pre-wean drenching of lambs? Yes, no, it depends, it's context, different species. What can you tell us about that?
Yeah, okay. So I will preface this by saying I am no expert in animal health, but from my understanding of what goes on in that whole area, the real issue pre-wean is nematodirus. Nematodirus occurs basically south of the Waitaki River. Those guys need to be on their toes, and it's probably going to rear its head from mid-November onwards. So that's really crucial. The other piece of information, and if you really want to go down that whole track, I suggest probably you set up and get Dave Leswick on and have a really good yarn with him. But my understanding is that if you do a fecal egg count when the lambs are very, very naive, you may well see extremely high number of eggs in the feces. It may not mean that there's a lot going on in the animal, because the animal, as it gets more tolerant, actually starts to suppress egg production. So it may only be one or two worms producing a lot of eggs because there's no suppression in the system. So it's very hard to make a decision about whether or not you should drench based on those early fecal egg counts. But again, my understanding is really, if we're talking about things you should be looking for, it's nematodirus, and mostly in southern New Zealand. The rest of New Zealand, probably not too much of a problem. Obviously, you're going to have to keep your eye out, especially as you do start to get maybe into December, or if you're weaning really late into January, you'll need to keep your eye out for that. But most of the time, it's really not economic to follow a pre-weaning drench for lambs. It's certainly not a tailing drench for lambs. That is... all the work that they've done on the East Coast of North Island up here showed relatively clearly that didn't provide any improvement in performance.
Good. Well, small plug for the Beef and Lamb New Zealand podcast channel. And we've actually got an interview with Dave Leswick on there, and from memory, actually covers some of those exact topics. It was nearly an hour just on internal parasites. Just on nematodirus, south of the Waitaki River, why is that? Is it cool winter, or what's the reason? We've got facial eczema coming south with global warming, climate change. Are we going to see nematodirus heading north?
No, hopefully it'll get further south. It'll only be an issue on Stewart Island one day. I'm not quite sure how the life cycle works. I just haven't stored it on the top of my head, but it's certainly around about how that life cycle goes and how it works in the cooler climates.
All right, I want to just expand a wee bit, moving on, we're sort of jumping around and back and forth a wee bit. One of the topics you touched on before was around the weaning decision isn't just for lambs, it's for ewes, and the opportunity to start the conception, the production cycle again, and uddering of ewes is something that is probably underutilised in the industry, and we certainly recommend it. I've heard you speak on it. You talked about not doing it on the day, giving them, I think, 3 to 4 weeks. Do you want to maybe just expand a wee bit more on the process? You're allowing them 3 to 4 weeks, just to dry up a little bit so that any faults are obvious, and then how do you go about doing it?
Yeah, so that's exactly right, Aaron. Really, you need them to dry off so that the hardness of the udder or whatever you see is not for the fact that it's just full of milk. You can actually feel that it is truly a hard udder where a side might not be working. So basically you're groping the ewe and you're looking for hard lumps. You're looking for cysts in the teat ducts. You're looking for potentially you might find that there's no teat there at all. So that's not going to be so flash if she's rearing twins or triplets. So you're looking for those kind of faults. I would suggest very strongly that you get your vet alongside you so that you can actually give yourself a bit of a training day on what you're looking for, because they'll be able to give you some good instruction on how to do it. It is definitely well worthwhile going through the process and making sure, because there's nothing as frustrating as ending up with a ewe who can't feed her lambs the following year and you see two good lambs going to waste because you know you haven't sort of checked through. It usually, again, if you're leaving them that 3 or 4 weeks, you're only finding the ones that are truly a problem, and the culling rate should be reasonably low in most flocks. But it is worth doing.
Great. Now, we've got a bunch of questions. I might just change the order a wee bit. We've got a bunch that, even though we're super talking about the weaning decision, there's a number of them around tailing and things like that. But I want to talk back. You talked about setting up a good weaning starts, you know, right back the day they lamb, their condition, the cover at that point, and obviously that starts even earlier. How do we get to that point? How do we get a ewe to a good condition score at lambing with reasonable cover? And do you want to expand a wee bit on some of the theory behind that went into some of the work you did in Southland and South Otago around the 4-day shifting? And particularly, so this is quite a multifaceted question, David, but varying.
I see it getting bigger all the time.
throwing in it. I know part of the reason around that was not just to get ewes in good condition, but to try and address some issues around bearings or redbacks. So there's a lot of reasons why that went in, but I think some of the theory is pretty standard across them all, how you wanted to feed stock and where you wanted to get them to.
Yeah, okay. So
We'll get there for a start.
One of the projects that we did have was looking at how we might prevent bearings, and through some conversations with farmers, they told us that if they only shifted sheep every 4 days instead of every day, they reckoned that they got a lot less bearings in their ewes. So we were trying to explore exactly what would be the reason for that, because it doesn't make a lot of sense, you know, on the face of it. So what we did was, again, we had quite a few farms in this program, and we only chose farms who had a problem with bearings. And we got them to either split their flocks in half and then either shift them daily through the winter. And the general thought was that was from the time the ram came out through to scanning. So it was an early season issue. Versus feeding once every 4 days. Now, the allocation per day or per ewe per day was exactly the same in both cases. So what that really means is you either have them on, you know, 1 hectare every day, or you actually have them on 4 hectares for 4 days. So the allocation is exactly the same. What we found in that process, a couple of things that we found. One is that there's a minor reduction in bearings, not by very much, but in between those two things. But there was actually a big reduction in bearings by the fact that we actually held condition on the ewes and fed them to appetite rather than getting them skinny and then going into lambing skinny. So that was quite a key finding for us, was to actually maintain that condition and keep the ewe fed properly. Actually helped us reduce bearings in total, regardless of what process we used. The other thing that we did find was that if we were shifting ewes only every fourth day, we were actually getting better utilisation of the feed, and the ewes were much more settled in the paddock. So they wouldn't be running around looking for the next blade of grass and competing with their neighbours and trampling it all into the ground. They were actually quite calm and collected, and actually shifted much better and utilised the feed better, especially in really wet conditions, which was interesting to us. We thought, well, if we leave them there for 4 days, we're just going to trample the hell out of it. And that wasn't the case at all. They actually, because they were calmer, they just worked their way through it and quite happily utilised the feed that was there rather than wasting it. So it had quite a few upsides, really. But like I say, the key in the whole bearing story was feeding them to appetite and making sure that they weren't straining and stressing and all those other things actually improved the situation quite significantly.
So just a plug here for a website. I'm going to just pick on one wee bit of that, but just a plug for a website that contains a lot of that trial data. It's farmingsheep.co.nz. Is that right? You've been involved?
Yeah, that's right. Yep.
That's, should have written
still
that
up and running.
So we'll send the link on that out, the follow-up email, but a lot of this trial data is on there. Now, one of the things I really picked up on that four-day shifting was it saved work, obviously, and the sheep were quieter. And I understand there was one farmer worked that if he did a four-day shift and then a three-day shift, he only ever shifted the sheep all winter on a Monday and a Friday and never had to shift on a weekend. So there's a wrinkle on that. But the issue behind it was that I remember you talking about it, David, it required a lot of good planning, measuring the feed, doing your feed budget, your feed planning. And the other side of that was good condition score of the ewe and holding that right through winter became predictable, not just something that happened by chance because of weather conditions. Am I recalling that correctly?
Yeah, and I suppose that the planning element and making sure you get things right was actually quite crucial. We had one particular farmer who had plate meters, he had GPS'd his paddocks, he had his feed budget, he knew everything that was going on the farm, except he didn't know the live weight of his ewes. Now, he had assumed from all of the field days and monitor farms he'd been to that Southland ewes were 65 kilos, so he budgeted as if they were 65 kilos. He described to us how he couldn't understand, with all his budgeting, they always lost weight in winter. Well, we went in and we measured them on the 15th of May, and they were 72 kilos. Now, if you feed a sheep as if it's 65 kilos and it's 72 kilos, it will eventually meet its target. It will get down to 65 kilos. So he was always losing a condition score on his ewes, even though he did everything else right. He just didn't know one really important piece of information, and that was the weight of his ewes. And it just highlighted to us how important the whole process is. You can't just guess at a bit of it somewhere along the line. So I suppose to me, it really highlighted that you can do all the numbers you like, but the real key in there is to monitor the stock by putting your hand on them. And if the feed budget is telling you lies, the sheep will let you know. So don't lose your stock sense in all the numbers. Make sure that you're going out and checking.
So, weighing and body, you took about that, putting your hand on them, body condition scoring. How often or what are the key times of the year that you encourage sheep farmers to body condition score their ewes?
So depends on how your approach. There are two reasons to condition score. And so we talked about the weaning decision and putting your hand on them at weaning and making sure you know which the fat ones are and which the average ones, the good averages, and which are the ones that need work, right? Now, the reason you do that is so that that's a trigger point where you can then work on those sheep to get them to the right condition at mating to then take them through winter. But once you get them to mating, you might put your hand on them again, but the point there is you should have already reached your target. So that's around monitoring whether or not you've got to your target. And somewhere in between those two points, you should be checking to see how close you're getting to your target. By the time you get into the middle of winter, again, that's mostly checking to see whether your feed budget's right or not. And then going, okay, am I going to change anything? Can I change anything? What am I going to do about it? So I had a guy in the tin country. What he was doing was he'd got to a point where he said, shit, I can't do this with my feed budget. Okay, what I need to do is take out all the good condition singles and I need to borrow a little bit of energy out of them, a wee bit of feed off their back to make sure that the rest of my sheep get the feed that they need, right? So again, making a decision with that piece of information about how you do something. By the time you get to vaccination time, just before lambing, what you'll be doing there is going, are any of these sheep now vulnerable in terms of is anything in a condition score 2, which I'm going to have to look after going through lambing, and where are they going to go on the farm? So again, it's about, this is my decision-making point, right? I wouldn't usually suggest anyone condition score them at tailing. We do condition score them at tailing to know what's going on. It's not usually useful. So your next point is that pre-lambing point. So which way are they going? Where are they at? And then again, the really important one to me is back to weaning again.
We started off talking about that bit of work and some of the things around body condition score and getting the ewe to, that key body condition score at the day of lambing, because some of it came from work around bearing. So it's a wee bit of a convoluted segue into the next question, which is around tail length, which came in, which is technically not a weaning issue, but does the length we cut tails or use a rubber ring to take tails off lambs have an impact on bearings? And while we're on that subject, is there any other, other animal welfare issues? Should we be leaving longer tails on lambs or what about, and so this is one of those multifaceted questions again, David, what about, leaving tails on lambs that are going to the works at growth rate? So where do you want to start?
We'll start there. So the theory in that process was if your tail dock too short, you cut off one of the key muscles which holds the vulva and all those other things in. The evidence doesn't really suggest that very much at all. Tail length doesn't appear to be related to bearings. However, that muscle that they're talking about is actually quite important to lift the tail when the animal is defecating or urinating. And it's actually, which is why the trend back to long tails or longer docking, is to actually allow that muscle to work properly so that it lifts its tail out of the road, which is quite key. So actually, it's not only a good animal welfare practice, but it's also quite a practical thing to make sure that the animal works properly, I suppose. But the extension of that then is then why do we take the tails off at all, especially if a single-born lamb is going to go straight off its mother to the works. And it's a pretty fair call, really, in two ways. And the first one, again, is an animal welfare issue. Why would you bother putting an animal through that that stress or pain? And therefore, the theory is that the animal should grow faster. The evidence would suggest that the animal feels that pain if you're using a rubber ring for maybe half an hour or an hour. And that's not a hell of a long time to go without a dinner. And so there's probably not much productivity lost in that process. And that would be the general thought. I think the work that the Abacus Bio people did on a reasonable scale basically couldn't find any difference in getting lamb growth rates between those that were docked and those that were left whole-tailed. So like I say, yes, the pain is significant, but it's over a very, very short duration compared to the length of time you've got to recover that live weight or that intake. Yeah. So.
Cool. So, I suppose back to the
leave the tail on hold. It's about, that may well be about just about ease of work or all those other things, if you know that you're going to keep those lambs clean and all those sort of things. So there's a whole heap of other side advantages to not bothering with that.
Yeah. Right.
It may not be quite the same in, say, Northland, where you're going to get fly quite early in the season and all that sort of stuff. It might not be an option at all.
Uh-huh. All right. I'm just looking at time. I think we'll covered a lot, and we've been back and forth. And I just want to, the next one that actually does flow on from that is, you touched a wee bit on it, or you mentioned it before, creek grazing of lambs, which can be an opportunity sort of between, you know, from early lambing to get, reduce that competition to a degree and therefore get better weaned weights of lambs. I wanted to talk a wee bit about, when we talk about creek grazing, we're not talking about what they tend to do perhaps in the Northern Hemisphere, the UK, which is actually offering additional feed. It's just letting the animals, the lambs have first pick without competition. Do you want to talk a wee bit about the theory, what the results we've actually found in practice, and maybe also when it doesn't work in farm systems?
Yeah, okay. So Ray Moss and the team at Lincoln did quite a bit of work on creek grazing and looking at when that would work, and they started out with the hypothesis that you would be able to feed lambs fresh feed without internal parasite challenge and all those sort of things, and it sort of developed on into, okay, so what if you just were able to let the lambs go ahead of the ewes? The bottom line is it just proved to us that the ewe is the most serious competitor for the lamb. So when feed is tight, then creep grazing can certainly make sure that the lamb continues to grow at a good rate. And under those circumstances, you maybe even be able to take a little bit of weight off the ewe at that time. Now, we're not suggesting that's a good thing, but some days the conditions are such that maybe that's what has to happen if we're trying to keep that going. I suppose part of the other issue in there was, again, the socialisation of the lambs to the point where they were comfortable not being with their mothers. So it's quite a useful technique from about 7 or 8 weeks of age, where you start to see that effect really start to kick in, and that's when the lamb is really starting to eat a lot of grass. Around about there, and you start to see that's where you get the divergence between leaving the lamb on its mother or giving it the opportunity to get into that extra feed or that higher quality feed in front of the main mob, so to speak. And then that also then makes the whole weaning process so much simpler because they're actually used to being away from their mothers. Yeah.
Great. No, good as gold. We've got a...
Have you got information on that on the website?
We have, yeah. No, there is a fact sheet that summarised the work that Ray Moss and co did. We've run a few field days on it, and it talks a bit about, the process. What we're talking about here is basically a gate with the bars wide enough apart that the lambs can slip through, and so it's not teaching a lamb to sneak through a fence or become a fencing bloody thing, but just let the lambs go ahead as David was talking about there. So we'll send out the link and make the link available to that. It also talks, interestingly, about the times, and you touched on it, David, when it doesn't work, when there's not a shortage of feed, there's not the competition there, or I think in some particularly large blocks, it was just the opportunity to get through the gate was too small relative to the mob size and the area. It just wasn't being very effective. Just looking at time, David, I think I'm going to call it to a close there. I don't know whether you've got any last thing that you've recalled that you desperately wanted to get across to people before we wrap up.
I would just say that the whole weaning process should be very much about farmers taking control of what they're doing on farm. So that's all the way from understanding how that quality and quantity is working. It's about understanding the inventory of what you've got, because that's really is where the nub of your production starts and ends. And so it's getting control is about that. It shouldn't be because the kids are home on holiday.
Fair point. All right. Look, we've come to the end of the time, so I am going to wrap it up there. The recording of this call will be up on the Beef and Lamb New Zealand podcast channel very soon, and we'll make available the links to a number of the documents that we covered. We've covered a lot tonight. It's ranged right throughout the year, which I suspect that it would, looking at some of the questions that have come in, and given that David, you know, stressed right at the start that the weaning decision is ultimately the culmination of a whole lot of other decisions and the start of a whole lot of other opportunities on the farm. So, look, thank you very much to our guest tonight, David Stevens, calling in, I think, somewhere in the North Island, David. It's been a pleasure to have
Napier
you on.
Napier tonight.
Napier tonight, and who knows where tomorrow night. It's been a pleasure to have you on the call, David, and it's been a really informative hour. So thank you, and good night.
Good night.